Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. I am your host, Wade Wojcik. I'm joined by David Ishida.
Hello, everyone.
Ben Robertson.
Good morning.
The late great. Ben Robertson.
Yeah, he's dead. All right, here we go. Episode 10. Congrats.
10.
We've done 10 of these now, officially. And
we have to do something special for 12.
Why 12?
Because it's the end of the year.
One year.
We do one episode a month. And that's a good call. I like that.
We'll have to do a video one or something.
A video one?
Yeah.
Sure. So basically, if you haven't listened to this podcast before, we do it in a three-tiered style. First, we break down tools of the trade and indie filmmaking, where we talk about a different category of production equipment. And then we do tricks of the trade, where we talk about different filmmaking techniques, different modes of film theory and style and artistic intent. And then finally, we each see a movie and we talk about it. This month, we saw Logan. So we're really excited to talk about that. Tricks of the trade, we're doing continuing an established tone or feel of a series while keeping it fresh and relevant. So looking at different series like Star Wars and James Bond and Batman, and how different directors have taken that source material over the years, kept it similar, but also adapted it. And then tools of the trade, starting it off, we're talking about lights, very important part
of lights.
Indie filmmaking. And God, so just real quick before we dive into the specific lights that we're going to be talking about, at MCTC, my filmmaking school, we shot on film and we didn't have LEDs back in those days. We used the old
tungsten, Airy tungsten?
Yeah, Airy Fresnels.
Yep. Well, I mean, they're tungsten lights.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Fresnel style.
Right, Fresnel's like
the lens.
The type of lens it has. Anyway, so very nice, very expensive lights. They got hot.
Very hot. You could cook a roast on those. You could cook eggs at least.
You had to make sure that you had
gloves.
Well, yeah. But also enough like ampage and wattage to run those
on some of those, especially when you get to, get to the next sort of step up from the smaller interview style lights, you have to be careful. You can put one on a normal household circuit. If you put two on, you're going to trip the circuit.
I think I have tripped circuits with those before, filming at my house at the time. But
when it's always also great when you're in that situation and you're at a location where you can't get to the fuse box or can't get there quick. Like that happened to me in high school, where we would trip breakers, but then we would have to call custodial to come and, go to like the other side of the building to where the fuse box was. And it was always a huge delay.
It's always an interesting jump going from filming as a kid with using available light to light kits and having to learn how to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we've come a long way. Now we use LEDs.
Yeah. And I really think that lighting is one of the two most overlooked things in indie filmmaking nowadays. It's that and audio. Everyone makes a big deal about the camera and your lenses, but people overlook audio and lighting. Mm-hmm. And like for me, both of those things, like if those are bad, it's almost an immediate, turn off to a piece of content if they didn't take the time to get good mics and good lighting.
With the respect of lighting, though, there's so much content now that people are consuming that are just point and shoot, not home video. I mean, that term's kind of obsolete now, but just people filming on their phones with available lighting.
Trying to adapt with no extra lighting.
So I think people are just, in general, used to that look and maybe aren't too caught up in wanting fancy lighting. Not to say it's not important, but one of the trailers I saw leading up to Logan in the theaters was a film called Song to Song, starring Ryan Gosling, Michael Fassbender, Natalie Portman. Shot very handheld, wide-angle lenses, almost like an anti-traditional Hollywood film style. Mm-hmm. And I don't know this for sure, but it looked like they just used available lighting. So
I remember that. I think there's more lighting in there than one would think.
Okay, and there very well could be, but I guess just like as far as a look is concerned, it has that, like, obviously it's made, with much higher quality filmmaking, but some of it looks like it could just be shot on a phone, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in a certain sense, that is the goal of lighting, is to, you don't notice lighting. But when you do notice lighting, it's usually for a very specific reason.
Mm.
Like they want you to see something, but what's it trying to do? You're trying to replicate the sun coming through a window,
sure.
Moonlight, the lights in a, coming from an airplane window, that kind of thing.
Definitely. But the LEDs that we're going to focus on, there's two different ones. One's a singular, one's a kit, different price ranges. The first one, the Camerar Brightcast. It's a single LED monitor. And this
LED light.
LED light. Yeah.
Monitors is the last episode.
Yeah, I know. I'm getting twisted up here. This one goes for $499 on Camerar.com. And just looking at it, it looks incredible. It's two-tone, so it can go between
cool or bicolor.
Or bicolor.
Yeah, and that's a thing to really look at when you're looking at lights nowadays, is because I think finally within the last about year and a half, LED lighting has come to the point where bicolor is viable. If you had gotten a bicolor light, say, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the problem that you would run into is because it had to do both. You basically had half as many LEDs if you're at one end or the other, daylight or tungsten. Mm-hmm. So that was one reason why, like, when we first got our light kit, I pushed that we didn't get a bicolor, because at that point we would have had such a large loss in light output that it would become almost pointless. But it's relatively easy to gel a daylight lamp to tungsten.
Right, which is what we've had to do.
So is this just getting two different temperatures? Is that what the
yes,
goal is?
Yes, yep, two different color temperatures.
And not only that, but like...
Everything in between.
Yeah, everything in between. Mm. So just a little bit of a background. The light kits we were talking about at the top of the podcast, the Airy Fresnels, you would have to use a gel if you wanted a specific color temperature with those. You couldn't dial in, you know, the look you wanted. So with these, it's really nice, and I've used them before.
Dial on the back.
You have a dial on the back. You set up your light, and then you can look with your eye or look through, you know, a monitor and slowly dial down from cool to warm or warm to cool and just get a look that really is nicely dialed in.
And it's also helpful if you're in a mixed lighting situation. If you have inside incandescent lights, but you're also having daylight coming through the window, you can better match that sort of mix, which is also a good thing at that point to have a color or a light meter. But a lot of people don't have that, but that's probably a discussion for another time.
And so this LED panel also can curve.
Yep, so this is another new trend that started in about the last year, is flexible lights, or because of how small we can make LEDs, people are finally getting around to mounting them on flexible materials.
Yeah.
There are some other ones made by a company called Westcott, where it's like it's on a sheet of, you know, plastic, where you can completely bend it into, you know, take a square light and roll it into a cylinder.
So what utility does that serve?
The two nice things is, one, you can get it into a lot of weird places that, you know, if you needed to. One, because they're so thin, you could stick it onto the roof of a car or the ceiling of a car. If you need to light your subject in the car, you can stick it to the ceiling and light them that way.
Yeah.
And also, because they are flexible and so thin, they're light. So you don't need to necessarily have a huge light stand to hold the light. You could, you know, if you're going like on a wall or something, you could just gaff tape it to the wall.
Yeah.
That's it.
I like too how, you know, because you can curve it in or out, you know, convex or concave, you can make it almost like a multi-directional light.
Yeah.
If you don't want to just shine a light in one direction, you can bow it out and then you're shining in like a general space.
Mm-hmm. Or conversely, you can bend it inwards and focus it down a little more.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Does it work? Does it really kind of focus the light a little bit if you do that?
It does a little bit. Like, you know, it's still not going to hold a candle to getting a Fresnel style light that has a focusable element to it in barn doors. But it does do more than old lights could do.
Yeah, this panel is also a V-mount.
Yeah, that's another thing you really need to look at carefully when you're getting LED lightings, because that's the other convenient thing is, as you were saying, Wade, old tungsten lights, like, you couldn't generate or you couldn't power them with batteries.
Yeah.
You needed wall outlets or you needed a generator of some kind. And on all these newer ones, they have, you have all sorts of ways to power them with different batteries. And with this particular one, it's V-mount. Now, V-mount is a very common style of battery. Mm-hmm. It's a larger one. So one downside is, if you're going to get one of good quality, like from a company, like one IDX makes of good V-mounts, they're like $200 or $300 per battery.
Yeah.
Granted, on a light like this, a battery like that could probably power that light for about 2 hours, which is a long time.
So is it on a separate module then, like with a cord that goes to the panel?
Not with this one. So with this one, unlike,
it's flexible. I feel like you want
this one,
that
only the sides are flexible. So down the middle, there's like the actual AC power supply runs on the middle, and then there's a mount for the battery. So it's not like that Westcott one I was talking about that can bend completely. That one does have a separate power supply you run a cable to. But, you know, that Westcott one is much more expensive.
So with all these features and this kind of emerging technology, this sounds like really expensive though, right?
It doesn't have to be. Again, like when you look at 5 years ago, the main LED light maker was what we call them now, that, you know, it's like Kleenex light panel.
Mm-hmm.
Was the first ones that made LED 1x1 square lighting. And they used to be, and light panels still are very expensive. Like, if you want to get one of the newer Astras, they're like $2,000 or $3,000 per instrument. Mm-hmm. And with these ones, though, you know, this one was $500 or so?
$499.
$499, yeah. Yep, mm-hmm. for this one. So the price has come down a lot. But you do need to look at, as I said, like, how are you going to power it? And also another thing to keep in mind, excuse me, is the CRI value. So CRI is basically measuring the quality of the light. The higher the number, the closer to 100, the more accurate the light is. And when you get to cheaper ones, you may have lower CRI values, which for some people may not make that big a difference. But if you're starting to look like really critically at the light, you may want to look at something that has a higher CRI value.
Is that comparing it to light from the sun, or like what is 100 CRI?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. Mm. I just know a bigger number is better.
Interesting. The other kit we're going to talk about is a three light kit.
Yep, classic lighting style. Yeah. As both you and I, Wade, were trained on.
Oh, yeah.
Think of interview lighting.
Right.
Fill, background, and key.
Yeah, so this is the ICANN Lyra Bicolor 3-point LED soft panel light kit with 1xLB10 and 2xLB5. Like it.
That's a mouthful.
BHphotovideo.com goes for $1,800. And these don't look like they're curvable, but what advantage do you get with this kit over the single panel?
So with this one, again, we're looking at getting a kit. So not just a single light, but a kit. Because with this one, you know, you have that flexibility. You have a larger one that's sort of your background light to light up your background. And then you have two smaller lights that is for your key light, so your subject. And then fill to help, you know, fill in where light is needed. So this one would aid very well to your starter kit, because you can do a lot with three lights. You know, even if you're not doing a traditional interview, you're shooting a narrative scene, you can still do everything you need to with these lights. You have the large one you can point and bounce off the ceiling to get some nice fill. And then you have the other two to help focus in on, you know, your subject or your background or things like that.
Yeah, these are also bicolor. So all three mm-hmm. lights are bicolor, yep. and they are V-mount battery yep. as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And for some of these, there are like another common battery type is the Sony BPU batteries. Those are the ones that power our light panels. It's a very, very common battery. You can find them anywhere, everywhere, and they're very cheap too. But usually, you know, because of how much smaller they are than V-mounts, you're not going to get nearly as much battery time on them.
So how well do these last? Is not so much, I understand LEDs last quite a bit of time, but as far as staying relevant within the industry, you know, you're throwing down money, you want it to last, right?
Interesting that you bring that up, mm-hmm. because one thing I recently found is that the new Star Wars Rogue One was shot almost entirely with LED lighting, which is a big shift for mm-hmm. anything in Hollywood. There is some rare exception where there were some scenes they needed more power than LEDs can do right now. And so they use another kind of style of light called HMI, which would be a discussion for another time. But the power of LEDs is getting brighter and brighter. You know, if you compare our lights, which we picked up 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was
maybe more.
I think it was four.
At least 4 years
ago. Okay, 4 years. We'll say 4 years ago compared to, you know, the other LEDs that we buy right now, the difference is huge in what it's capable of.
Yeah. And just a real quick... a couple other things about this kit. Obviously, not obviously, it's obvious to me because I'm looking at it. Each light has a set of barn doors on it, which is nice. Mm-hmm. The other LED panel, I don't think, had barn doors.
Yeah, and that's actually another thing to point out with when you're shaping with LEDs. Most LED lights that you get nowadays are the light panel style. They're square or rectangular. A common size is 1 by 1, 1 foot by 1 foot square. A downside to LED lighting that you have to consider, especially when you're doing some narrative stuff, is shadows. When you have a square emitting light that large, you can get an effect of multiple shadows mm-hmm. created by things because your light source is a foot wide.
Yeah.
Versus older traditional tungsten, where our light source is a 1 inch by, you know, 1 inch, you know, filament section of a bulb. And so there are other LEDs that you can get that have a Fresnel style lens that are more directional sure. and more focused and for that. But with those, they tend to get more expensive.
They do bring that up well. Here. Soft source single shadow, according to the info on these.
Yep. And that is, they are getting better, that style. And that a lot, some of that is coming down to diffusions that are going in front of them. That's one thing with the camera art that if you look at that one, it is the raw LEDs are out there. So it's very harsh lighting. So for those times, it's often good to get a soft box of some kind, something that's diffusing the light a little bit. Mm-hmm. And with these ICANNs, that diffusion is built in and is part of it.
Yeah. And then also there are little LCD panels on the back of these light panels mm-hmm. that show you battery power, color temp, dim percentage. Yep. That's pretty handy too.
Yep. Yep. That's really useful because, you know, when you're going around to all these lights, it can be difficult to then have to, you know, click on the battery to see what the battery percentage is, because on different V mounts, some of them have just LED dots and say, okay, it says it's around 50%, but that's meaning that it could be between 40 and 60% technically. Mm-hmm. And so that is a very convenient thing when you're just monitoring these lights and need to jump around quickly and say, okay, this one needs a new battery, this one doesn't.
Yeah, ultimately, I think between the two of these, these are really good for servicing whatever needs you have for mm-hmm. for a modest shoot. I mean, obviously, yeah. these aren't like... You want more lights for a bigger shoot, but, you know, starting with the camera R and then moving up to the iCan, like that's going to serve a lot of your needs.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, moving on, we are going to be talking about tricks of the trade, continuing established tone/feel for a series while keeping it fresh and relevant. Be right back. So we're going to be talking about three different series that have lasted throughout the decades, at least three, I think, for all these, if not
yeah,
more.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that. Yeah, I think they all of these have yeah. spanned decades.
Plural. So we'll start off with Star Wars is the go-to to me. So this film is on its third trilogy of feature films, not including the animated TV series.
Mm-hmm. Spinoffs.
The spinoffs, the books.
The holiday special. Yeah.
All the different side content. We're going to be focusing on the core feature films, and I guess Rogue One as well. We'll toss that in there. Mm. So so obviously, everyone looks to the original trilogy for its established tone, which wasn't completely George Lucas. He did the first episode four.
Directed episode four,
and is credited with creating the universe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a little bit of controversy with, you know, the prequels and fans questioning how much he actually, you know, how much he knows about, like, why people love the universe and, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I imagine when he made the first trilogy, there were a lot of people questioning him, kind of like giving him different ideas and kind of fine tuning his artistic ideas into something else that was more enjoyable, approachable, and then maybe for the prequels, he was
refined,
just he was just like, all right, this is going to be an unbroken stream of consciousness of George Lucas.
Yep. And with that one, some of it could also be looked at because he was directing again and doing screenwriting and producing, that there was no man mm-hmm. there to say no, George. Checking that's a bad balances. Idea because you can't say no to George Lucas.
So I guess to get it to a finer point, how do you guys think episode 7 measured up to this metric of keeping being consistent with the Star Wars universe and its tone, but also reinventing itself and keeping it fresh?
I think that the characters and the plot structure felt very similar to just the original tone in the series.
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty obvious. People have been critical or praised it for that. However, I think the style of the way that it was shot was much more akin to what we see currently mm-hmm. as far as faster cuts are staying handheld more often than on sticks. There's like maybe one or two shots that I can think of specifically, like on Jakku, where there's where Rey is on her speeder going across the desert, where that's your scene, super wide, mm-hmm. And you don't see those really often too much anymore, I feel like, in movies, or specifically these kind of action adventure movies.
But one thing I think that's interesting is, in some ways, Episode 7 was influenced by some of the stylistic choices in the prequel trilogy. Mm. One thing I think of is, this is not unique to Star Wars, but we have these long, like, unbroken shot, like CG shots that are all CG.
Oh, sure.
Or primarily CG. And
are you talking about the episode 3?
I am.
The opening shot?
Yeah, that opening shot where you know, you're following the starfighters, and everyone always, when that movie came out, like, oh my gosh, it was one unbroken shot. And like, well, it's digital. You can do whatever you want with it. Of course it can be unbroken. But if you look in that in episode 7, you have not as many, but you still have some long moments, especially in the fight on Starkiller Base, when you're falling around X-Wings for long swaths of time. And also with when the Resistance first comes to save them at Maz's place.
Where Finn's chasing after
him. Yeah, when you see this long tracking shot as you see Finn snake up above and, you know, shoot down like 10 ships.
No, that wasn't Finn.
Sorry, not Finn.
Poe does that, but there's another scene where it's a longer shot where Finn is running, trying to chase after Rey, where it's a longer shot.
But again, that's more real stuff. Sure, that's more. I'm talking about like the long like space battle CG shots.
You know, I mean, yeah, they're cool, but because it's just a long unbroken CG shot, I just am not impressed by
those. Oh, absolutely, I agree. But I, you know, just looking at how Episode 7 was influenced, because you don't see those kinds of shots really in the original trilogy, but you do see them in the prequel trilogy.
Oh, sure.
And how it's interesting. Like, we want all these elements. We want this sort of nostalgia feeling that we get from the original trilogy, mm-hmm. but there are still influences of how filmmaking had changed since the prequel trilogy came out.
One of the big changes I notice is in the writing, specifically the dialogue. Like, think about when Finn was first trying to hit on Rey, when he was like, "You got a boyfriend? Cute boyfriend." And mm-hmm. just like, I am the Resistance. And just like, it was so, you know, kind of modern contemporary dialogue that's just taken straight out of what you'd see in like a comedy film in theaters.
Yeah. It's like Gilmore Girls. It's
a little bit,
it's kind
little
of
bit.
That snappy, like witty
and
dialogue.
Right, like, obviously people laugh at that, but I think it clashes with the Star Wars tone.
I think in contrast to the prequels, where they're all very like kind of serious.
Yeah, I'm not defending the prequels.
I know you're not, but when I see that as a better shift in tone, as far as having a character who kind of has a little bit of fun with what they're doing. I guess I didn't find
too much. Okay, maybe that. I don't mean that. What I mean is, given Finn's backstory, it seems weird that he has this kind of quirky sense of humor.
Because
he's like a stormtrooper.
A brainwashed
stormtrooper from birth. And all of a sudden he's kind of like, hey, like.
But socially awkward too, though.
Yeah, but you've got to pick that up somewhere, right? You don't just automatically have that weird quirkiness.
Yeah. And I'm thinking back, and you don't really have moments like that so much in the original trilogy. Like, the closest I can think of is, well, what have we here? As Lando saunters over to Leia.
Yeah.
But still, that's very different.
But that's his personality. He's like this smarmy business dude.
Yeah.
Kind of like a counter to Han Solo. Like, yep. they're both like these womanizing dudes in their own way, but they have their different style of doing that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot more we could dive into Star Wars, but we want to touch on a couple other series. The other one is James Bond.
This one has spanned many decades.
First one was it Dr. No? Was it Goldfinger? What was
the
first
Dr. one? No was the first one.
And it's really, I haven't watched the original, God, maybe first 20 films, but it was really cool reading about it, how it centers around this conglomerate of evildoers. And
Spectre, which recently has come back in the newer films.
From what I'm told, not very satisfactorily, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, well, no, we can get into it later, but just to establish it, I really like that was the intent and original intent with the series. Talking about differences, we touched this on this before we were recording, but obviously James Bond slaps a lot fewer women than he used to, and he's still kind of a womanizer, but at least now with Daniel Craig's Bond, he seems more vulnerable and affected by those relationships than he used to be, at least as a character.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like the stories have kind of shifted to be much more personal as far as to James himself, where I feel like some of the more older ones, they all seem like
they're like serialized adventures.
Sure.
Like, they're all like each one stands on its own.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the one adventure, and he's with these couple chicks in this one, and then the next one, there's never really reference to, oh yes, you just came back from saving so and so.
I think they're moving towards female empowerment as well. One big example is Penny from the 90s, like in
Monty Penny. So you're talking about
What was her first name?
Monty Penny.
Is that what it is?
Money Penny.
Sorry, it's been a while. Anyway, Money Penny in GoldenEye was this just non-character,
a damsel. She was a damsel.
She was just a wannabe damsel. She was like a grade below damsel. She was just like constantly like, oh, James, like da 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 da.
Cheryl from Archer reminds me of her now that I think about it.
And
random.
Anyway, Money Penny in Daniel Craig's Bond is going with him on missions, like much more.
She's a field agent.
Yeah. She's almost like a femme fatale in some scenes. Mm. In Skyfall, when she's like shaving him with a straight razor.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I forgot about that part.
Yeah. Oh, so right. she's much more. She has a much, much more agency than mm-hmm. she used to. So it is interesting. And another new take is also M. Mm-hmm. The new M is Ralph Fiennes. Yeah.
Rafe Fiennes, I believe, is what it is.
So a little gender bending.
Rafe,
there.
If we said your name wrong, please feel free to call me. I'd love to talk about it.
Or tweet at David Ishida. Is that your handle?
At the David Ishida.
The David Ishida.
I know it's bad.
Wow. Or David Ishida was taken.
Yeah.
Wow. And then Q. They have new Q as well.
Yeah, younger guy.
Mm-hmm. I forget his name.
And another interesting thing with, and we see with a lot of newer movies as people are either reimagining, rebooting, or making sequels to the previous movies, is this darker tone that we're more realistic. Yes. Because if you look at the earlier James Bonds, you know, we have all these moments where it's like, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Which brilliantly parodied in Austin Powers.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you have all these moments of like this evil organization, Spectre, it is the stereotypical evil organization. Like, they're after world domination.
Yeah.
Which, what does that mean? Yeah. Or they, you know, they have all these wacky, you know, or like James, like, you know, they have cars that turn invisible. He has, you know, belts that shoot grappling hooks or whatever. Yeah. And all the newer ones, it's like, yes, we're dealing with this evil organization of Spectre, but their world domination it's an understandable. They actually have a rationale for what they're doing and how they're accomplishing it. It's not like we're going to kill a bunch of people to become world dominant. It's like, no, we're going to control all the water.
Yeah.
And that's how we're going to become in charge of the world.
Which is kind of cool because that arc carries over across several films. I think they first established that in Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
Well, they... No, like, I have something. No, because what it comes up with in the first one in Casino Royale, because we're dealing with this an organization that is funding terrorism.
Oh, sure.
And then in the later ones, that organization is actually linked
to
a larger one. And then this part of my annoyance, then Skyfall, all that goes away.
Yeah.
For a movie, it disappears. And then it comes back again in Spectre.
I guess what I meant is it first explicitly says water.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah.
In Quantum Solace. Yes. But you bring up the kind of cheesy gadgets and invisible cars. I think to me, like, the peak ridiculousness was definitely Die Another Day with Pierce Brosnan. Mm-hmm. That was when he goes to, I think, the Arctic or the Antarctic, and there's like this.
Oh, is that the ski race on the Jag?
No, there's the chase with the supercars out in the ice.
Yeah, it's one with Halle Berry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And God, there's the scene where he's fucking like doing this kite surfing thing and the wave. It's all CG and it looks ridiculous. But there was one part of that film I did enjoy, and that's, I think, Q's final, like the old man Q's final film before he passed away, where he goes down to his lair. It's like in a subway, and he's like, I've got the latest and greatest in transportation. And they're standing by the subway track, and this lone platform slowly inches in. It's just this like little like platform thing on the tracks, and Bond kind of looks at Q and he says, maybe you've been down here too long. But of course it's the invisible car.
That one is, I think that one's a Jag, I think.
Yes.
I don't remember. Anyway.
But yeah, they have gotten a lot more gritty, especially the villains. And it's very noticeable that they've gone after kind of villain of the week actors, like the villain from No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
They really wanted him for Skyfall.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's pointed out, and they talk about this in some of the behind the scenes of Quantum of Solace, is, you know, in the old classic Bonds, we expect these people that look evil.
Mm-hmm.
They like, you know, like what's his face? Like he has that, like this, like he has the disfigured face. It's all scarred up. And they actually made a point in Quantum of Solace, the bad guy, Dominic, or whatever his name is, a guy in Hawaiian shirts all the time. They originally had a plan for him to have, I think, burns or scars on one half of his face. But then they're like, but that looks evil. This is like the smooth talking, good looking evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, is another.
I like that. And then
there's even a line in it in Casino Royale where Le Chiffre has the bleeding eye or whatever, and that bleeds, and he says, "Oh, don't worry, Mr. Bond. There's nothing diabolical."
Yeah. No. He's talking to
the poker players.
Yeah. So he's just. Well, he is looking at Bond when he says that. When he says nothing sinister, he kind of like glances his way.
No, that's earlier in the film. That's when he's having a poker game with a couple of random people on his boat.
Oh, you're right. He says like something, blah, 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 malfunction in the tear duct.
Yeah, there's a re-diverting of the tear ducts.
Wow.
Nothing sinister.
Memorized it.
So what it's do you, a good movie. Why do you think about, why do you think this tone has happened? Or this shift in, or is in the way that movies have been made?
Well,
to be more
we can
gritty.
Segue that perfectly into our hoping. Final yeah, yeah. one, which is Batman. Yeah. Specifically, Christopher Nolan and I think The Dark Knight from 2008 was definitely a turning point.
Begins or Dark Knight?
Well, I mean, obviously it wouldn't be what it is without Begins, but I think Dark Knight, as far as villains go, mm-hmm. is like, oh my God, like villains should be like this now. This
yeah.
Like, look, a good example is Batman v Superman, Lex Luthor. Mm-hmm. God, is he such a Joker wannabe
yeah.
in that movie. But yeah, so our last series we're looking at, Batman, Tim Burton had from his he had two films, right? Batman and Batman Returns.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which had the Penguin. And the first one had The Joker with Jack Nicholson. Those two films are considered to be classics, like Batman
yes.
classics.
Yeah, absolutely. And they established for those two and then the later films in that era, they established the look and feel of Batman.
Yeah, and I think this film series especially really hones in on different directors, four in particular, different directors taking the same source material and getting drastically different results. So obviously, real quick for Tim Burton, you've got that established gothic tone, you know, a little bit over the top, but still somewhat grounded and mm-hmm. entertaining and very visually stylized. Then you've got Joel Schumacher's, which is Batman and Robin. And I think that was his, right? Where you got the bat nipples
yep.
with George Clooney,
yep.
Widely considered to be the worst.
Yep.
And then you've got Chris Nolan, who took his, you know, darker, more serious, gritty tone, but also with his elements of, you know, psychological exploration
mm-hmm.
and questioning like duality of good versus evil and the war on terror and surveillance. And then you've got the most recent one, which is Zack Snyder and Batman v Superman and Ben Affleck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So I guess Tim Burton, I haven't seen that one in a long time. Do you guys remember seeing that for
I
the
do.
First time?
Yep. I actually, interesting, what I remember, of course, in this moment right now, I can't hum it, but what I think of is the music.
Mm. The
yes, that's yeah. it, thank you. Like that music actually stuck with me.
Danny Elfman, right?
Yep, yep. Yeah. And again, I feel like it so well is, it's capturing the live action of it, and also in a certain way calling back to, in my mind anyway, the styles of the animated series mm-hmm. and the old Batman, mm-hmm. The original, the TV show with
Adam West,
thank you.
Yeah.
It sounds like in that way, like it sounds like a little bit of both.
Yeah, because like Adam West, you know, obviously it was a product of the time, but looking at it now, super cheesy, you know,
yeah.
You know, the guys in tights. So mm-hmm. given that was out at the time for Tim Burton to look at for source material, mm-hmm. like it's incredible he got to where he did. But yeah, Tim Burton, obviously well known for his dark gothic, not like Chris Nolan dark, but like
wasn't it dark for the time, would you say?
It's dark but with charm.
It's
you know what I mean?
It's like classic comic book dark.
Like
it's not really dark, but it's dark.
Like Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
You know, it's dark, but it's got like a little bit of like a
it's dark with a wink.
Dark with a wink, yeah.
That's I'm trademarked that right now.
So, but yeah, parts of like, I'm thinking of his second one with the Penguin and Catwoman. Some of that is just like, you know, not gritty, but it's like when the you know, he's having his final confrontation with the Penguin and God, he's just like a sick looking character.
The moment I think of is in the first one, and it's when the, whatever the female character's name is, I don't remember. She's at the art gallery. And then she gets the thing put on the mask. And then I don't remember if that was a killing gas or if it was a knockout gas or whatever. But like everybody else is passed out or killed around her. And it's this moment like when, you know, but, you know, she probably doesn't know if everyone's dead or not. But then the Joker waltzes in with the boombox on his shoulder and they're like, they're jamming out. And then, you know, then they have their conversation and gets a little more.
Kim Basinger?
Yes.
That's what we're thinking
yes.
of?
Yeah, I don't remember her character's name. But,
yeah. Jack Nicholson as the Joker, brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant performance.
Absolutely.
And I remember hearing he was talking to Heath Ledger as he was getting ready for the role, and Jack Nicholson was basically like, this role will kill you, or something like that.
Yeah.
I remember hearing about that, too.
Yeah, that's sad.
Well, we talk about how The Dark Knight was pretty influential as far as shifting the series, but shifting the way that these darker these movies were made to be have like a darker tone
and shifted all superhero movies.
Yeah, which is interesting because it was based off of another take on Batman comic book series, I believe specifically called The Dark Knight.
Yeah. Yes. Many the style elements. The plot is different. That one is a bit further off, but it is. It's the darker, grittier, more realistic take on Batman, and because of the darker timeline that series is in.
So do you think that the draw of this grittiness then, or what do you think it is so much? Is just because it's more plausible or it seems more real or more genuine?
I think it's the reality because it mirrors our reality right now in our world. We're in this world where we hear about acts of terrorism and violence happening across the world every single day. You know, there's shootings in Afghanistan. There's a thing at a mosque here in the States. All those kinds of things are happening. And I think it's a connection, but it's something that we can recognize, but then also plays into a certain degree of escapism. Because, like, these terrible things are happening, but we have heroes fighting for us and on our side.
Yeah, and just looking back at, like, you know, even the well-regarded Tim Burton version, it's very visually stylized and hyper-real. Mm-hmm. Hyper-real, yep. I think, is the key phrase there. So Tim Burton, or Chris Nolan's version, while still a little hyper-real at times, feels much more grounded, especially how, like, in the beginning of Batman Begins, it's a huge buildup to him becoming Batman.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You know, he goes through his training. He goes through his adolescence with struggling with the trial of his parents' murder. And it's this big buildup of self-discovery and facing, you know, his own fears, which I liked a lot just because I wasn't super into Batman growing up. And I didn't really know much about the mythos of Batman. But then, so we're focusing on the good ones. Joel Schumacher, I feel like he looked at Tim Burton's version and was like, nope, it's not silly enough. It's not crazy and whatever. Like, he's got the Bat credit card.
But Wade, what killed the dinosaurs?
The Ice Age! God, you know, I love the ice puns. And God, our friend Lee, I think, still tries to defend this movie because he just like, yeah, it's fun. It's a fun movie and have a good time, which, yeah, fine, whatever. But
yeah, it takes it to a whole nother level.
It's like, even the people in it don't take it seriously.
Yeah, but I mean, like, in the one with Poison, it's the same one with Poison Ivy, like, isn't it at the bar when, like, she has, like, her seduction, like, mist on them? Like, God, he pulls out a Bat credit card.
Yeah.
Isn't that what that happens?
Because, like, they're trying to bid on her.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, it's like one of those, like, charity auction things. Yeah. Like, you win it, like, for a date.
And Robin and Batman are fighting over her, and all of a sudden it's just like, 1 million. 2 million, 10 million, cha-ching, never leave the home without it.
Wow.
And even in the very end, when Uma Thurman gets thwarted as Poison Ivy, she goes, curses! And it's just like the most over-the-top phoned
in. It's something you'd expect from the Adam West ones. Ooh. Like, that's the kind of dialogue and stuff and jokes. Because, like, you know, that's one thing from the Adam West ones is, like, there's all the jokes about the bat branded things. Yeah. There's the bat computer, the bat spray, the bat shield, which is this plexiglass folding shield that he pulls out of nowhere and it's huge.
And then, bat nipples on the suits.
Yep.
Which Bat Girl doesn't have bat nipples.
That's sexist.
Yeah.
That's sexist is what that is.
It's too provocative. And then lastly, Zack Snyder with his interesting take. You know, there's, to his credit, there's a lot of interesting Easter eggs that are taken straight out of some of the comics that people have noticed, but ultimately it doesn't matter if no one gives a shit about the story.
It's also interesting because the Dark Knight trilogy with Nolan is a darker, grittier, realistic one, and it's like Zack Snyder has taken that dark and gritty and taking it
goes a little too far.
Yeah, he goes too far with it. And it's still dark and gritty, but it's like a comic book dark and gritty that's become unrealistic in its realism.
Well, it reminds me of Watchmen a little bit, actually, as far as
also a Zack Snyder film. When you think about it,
didn't like that one either. But I wasn't a fan of the graphic novel to begin with. Anyway,
what
I know,
we're gonna talk later.
Ha! I don't like any of the characters in Watchmen.
I mean, maybe liking the characters.
To be fair, I don't think we've had a full Batman movie though with Zack Snyder. I mean, it would be interesting to see what he would do with just that versus trying to put it in also with Superman, and just, then also at the same time trying to advertise the Justice League and doing all this other
stuff. I
don't
think that Zack Snyder had anything interesting to say about the character. Like, he didn't. Look at I mean, obviously the go-to is Chris Nolan, where he really wanted to examine Batman's struggle of, in the beginning, vengeance versus
justice.
Versus justice, you know, being afraid and letting the fear drive him, or facing that fear. Like, there's a lot of duality and like choices. Sure. Mm-hmm. And very interesting. And in Dark Knight, you know, you've got another duality and of like the necessary evil to go with Batman's good, and all these interesting tones and things that he's examining. And then Zack Snyder's like, hey, here's some awesome looking shots.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm arguing, I don't know if he had the choice to do that though, with whatever else that he had.
No, he had the choice. If you look at, you know, look at 300, look at Watchmen, look at Batman, stylistically, like it stands out as a Zack Snyder film. They all have such a similar color palette. It's also interesting looking at the Justice League movies. You know, someone was making a comment of, what is the color palette of the Justice League comics? Bright colors. You got orange and Aquaman. You have Batman in his black and sometimes a bit of blue. Wonder Woman, red and gold. Superman, blue and red. Those kinds of things. And then what is the color palette of the Justice League movie? Gray, brown, a bit of black, and some very muted red.
Sure.
Like, you know, just look at the color palette alone, and it's sort of this weird style.
Yeah. But anyway, that is our take on on Batman.
There's some nerves there, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really interesting. And not that we'll necessarily get the chance to direct any of these series one day, but it is fun to think about, you know, how we would do things differently. Maybe just me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And especially, you know, if you are looking at adapting either a style or a specific franchise that's older into a newer one, like what would be a new take on, I don't know, the Ten Commandments. Like, you know, if you reboot,
or
Ben
Hur,
like,
we should reboot that.
Oh wait,
and get
Morgan Freeman's
Redbox.
Oh.
Yeah.
Maybe the chariot race will be better if it's CG and not real. Oh
yeah. God, you think people would learn? Anyway, moving on, we're going to talk about Logan. So guys, Logan. I feel like I don't have enough facial hair to talk about this movie. God, yeah, that beard was
epic.
I'm
doing well. Ben, you're not doing well.
No, I have this mouse in my face. Oof.
They do not wait to dismember a ton of people. 30 seconds in, and we've lost two arms and a leg, and somebody got stabbed through the jaw.
I haven't seen X-Men 1 or 2, but I imagine there's not nearly enough blood or swearing.
No. Well, another interesting thing that I was talking about before the podcast was this was a rated R film. And from also what I hear, Hugh Jackman took a pay cut to make sure that it could be rated R. I think that probably had something to do with getting like distribution money and whatnot.
That's cool. That's really cool.
And you know, and this would have come off of Deadpool, the first rated R superhero film. Mm-hmm.
In general impressions, what did you guys think?
Ben? Yeah, we're starting with me. Yeah. I liked it a lot. I thought it was really great. I was caught off guard about Patrick Stewart swearing at me.
You fucking fuck. Yeah, that was great. Yeah, Patrick Stewart did a great job in this film.
Yeah,
I like this movie a lot, David.
Oh boy,
we go.
I liked it, but there was one, like, and when I look at sort of elements of it, there are a lot of things I liked. Like, I did like this old Logan. I liked the old Professor X. I liked this world where they're just trying to scrape by in many regards. And I called this from the very first trailer. This, I feel like, if you took out the superhero elements, this would still have been an interesting and compelling movie if everyone was just a normal human. Mm-hmm. The big thing that annoyed me with it, and I feel like this is not through any fault of the filmmakers or the actors or anything. This is an issue with how the Logan storyline, if you will, has evolved, is it felt like this story was the same as the other Logan films or the Wolverine-based films, where it's like, I'm gritty and angry and I don't care about anybody. And at the end of the film, it's like, I care about you. And
yeah.
And I felt like, and again, I don't think that's any direct fault because it's sort of been this fractured and it's not like they've been thinking about this being a bookend film for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, this sort of became over the last few ones. And actually an interesting, we're doing spoilers, right? We're doing spoilers.
Yep.
An interesting point that one of my friends mentioned about it is a callback though to the last film, The Wolverine movie, the one in Japan. One of the chicks in there who has like the clairvoyance, like the future sight thing, she makes the point of like, I can see your future and you die with your heart in your hands. And the end of this film, who is holding his hand?
Oh,
right.
Man.
Boom.
But I will say, I haven't seen the Wolverine.
Wolverine lost in Manhattan.
I haven't seen the...
God.
Lost in New York.
Lost in New York.
I haven't seen the Wolverine standalone films because
I'm missing the first one.
I saw the trailers and I was like, garbage, pass.
I saw them all.
So I don't have that bias, I guess, because to me, or not bias, but I don't have that stale taste in my mouth because I suppose
for
those.
You, the last one you would have seen that mainly involved him was Days of Future Past.
Yeah, that was the last one I saw because I missed the Revelations. What was the one that came out last year?
Apocalypse.
2 years ago? Apocalypse. Yeah. I haven't seen that one.
But that one didn't really have Logan in it.
Okay.
Did it at all? I don't know. It didn't have him in it at all.
So I did like, I liked how in this one he is much more vulnerable, not only emotionally towards the end, but so many times when we see Wolverine, he's like just this invincible dude who has limitless strength. And now he's like, no, I'm fucking dying. Like,
yeah.
This is the end
for
me. Yeah.
It was the first time I heard that it was addressed that he, or the reason why he was dying was the adamantium in his body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one thing that, back when the original X-Men, because X-Men is the first comic book movie that I remember watching, is the original X-Men. Mm-hmm. And so when that came out, I had done a bunch of research and looking into it. And one thing that's in the comics that's dealt with is the fact that the adamantium, his body is treating that as a foreign object that needs to be removed. And actually in the times in the comics when adamantium has been removed from him, his healing ability is almost instantaneous.
Oh, sure.
Because his regeneration is actually limited because it's trying to fight off and destroy the adamantium, but it can't because it's adamantium.
Yeah. So if he didn't have that in his body, he'd probably be much more healthy.
He'd be healing almost instantly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't think
he's
that.
Like centuries old too, right?
He's really old. Yes, because it's established in the X-Men Origins Wolverine, and actually in the comics too. He was born in 18 something.
Okay.
I think he's
150 years old.
Yeah, so he's been through the Civil War, both World Wars, Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Fighting in all of those.
Okay. Yeah. And I did like how, now he's like old. It took a while, but now he's old.
Well, I think he's old because his powers are, his aren't working as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then just a couple of the high points. By the way, one of the main points I wanted to bring up, you guys played Last of Us.
No.
Oh my God.
But I bet that relationship,
it's basically
the father-daughter.
It's basically like Last of Us the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So many things are similar.
Mm-hmm.
You have the jaded older guy that you follow who has to escort and look after the young girl, and they don't care about each other and it's a burden and they go through hardships and they have to rely on each other in specific ways. So very similar. I think as far as the story, Last of Us is way better, but this one was still good.
Yeah, I enjoyed this as a character movie. It looking at the relationship that Logan has with Professor X. Because the other thing that's alluded to in it is the incident in Westchester, which they talk about at the end. The fact that it looks like Professor X had a seizure of some kind, and it sounds like killed probably every mutant. In
they
the
say
mansion.
seven.
Okay,
deaths.
So but probably the main X-Men. So
oh,
he probably killed the X-Men.
I didn't put it together that was the mansion. They didn't say like it
was
the mansion.
Well, it's known because it's established. It's sort of an expectation. Westchester is where the mansion is in New York.
Sure,
New York State.
Oh, okay.
That's another like lore thing you need to know a little more. But that's so it's conceivable he killed the X-Men. So it's interesting.
Interesting.
You have Logan who probably again survived as he hasn't through the several. Seizure or seizure-like incidents in this movie is able to survive because of some of his regenerative
capabilities. And so now they're in hiding in Mexico.
And also, but you know, think about this, like you have someone you've cared for and who has cared about you and they go and though technically in some way through no fault of their own, killed all of your friends and you're still there taking care of that person. You're living with the person that killed seven of your closest friends mm-hmm. and your family.
That is interesting. And then it's especially sad when you consider the beginnings and younger years of that character from, mm-hmm. God, what was it? Not only Days of Future Past, but First Class. Mm-hmm. So like mm-hmm. when they first introduced young Xavier from like in like the 60s.
Yeah.
And now he's like this old, like
broken yeah. man who is, you know, fighting to stay himself.
It's especially sad because he's so compassionate and you know, caring of a person and just can't help hurting people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting how they withhold a lot of information from the audience as far as the world is concerned until like later on in the movie. Because like they don't explain like where all the mutants are. Or, yeah. Like, until
they make
the
some offhand comments about how there haven't been any new ones
yeah.
in a long time.
Yeah, they reveal that really slowly. And they don't give the final reason as to why there aren't any really left or why there aren't being more naturally occurring until like the last like five lines in the movie.
Can I say that's a wonderful that was a moment that I was I'm very satisfying.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
It's a very end. You have the Dr. Xavier, not Xavier, Xander, who was revealed like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm the one who was behind like introducing things in the food and water supply that reduced natural born mutants, and he's doing this monologue as evil villains do,
oh,
and he
yeah.
gets shot in the head,
yeah.
and that's it.
I did like that.
I find that satisfying the one that because that is such an unrealistic thing.
Yeah,
but also Wolverine though is guilty of the unrealistic thing in when the what's his face like robotic arm man
yeah.
came and he just knocks and he's knocked out and he's like, go dump him. It's like you should have just brained him right there.
Yeah, seriously.
It's like that would have nothing bad would have. Well, like, those bad guys would still be coming.
You have killed so many people in this movie up to this point without just like prejudice. Why save this dude?
Yeah,
because I don't think he wants to. I think that's the whole point is that he doesn't want to be a killer because that's what he was made to be.
Okay,
that was the whole
don't want to be a killer when the first 3 minutes of the film are killing a bunch of.
He didn't want to.
What? Okay. Well, so, yeah. it's why is it more of a threat? So these guys that are a threat in like they don't have a personal vendetta against Wolverine.
Yeah,
they're just trying to steal the wheels off the car. And he's fine with killing them, but then a person who he knows who it is a very real threat to him and
yeah.
and Professor
X. Just from a threat assessment level, he should have like been like, all right, I don't want more bad stuff to happen. I'm going to take him out.
Yep.
But obviously the movie has to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like him as a villain? I'm not sure if I really did. I thought he was kind of okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I was okay with him as a villain. I mean, he wasn't super strong.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely hated him. I wanted him to die.
Yeah.
I was really surprised, taken aback by the death of Professor X when he's having that heartfelt moment. And all of a sudden,
oh, yeah.
I was like, what are you doing? And it's just like, oh, okay, it's not actually Wolverine.
Yeah.
But it was just like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm. I know. I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting something with the X-24. I did see that coming because of reference. There's X-23, but then there are several shots before X-24 being the perfect Wolverine, the actual Wolverine clone.
Mm-hmm.
You did see his cage earlier, mm-hmm. like 10 or 15 minutes
oh,
before
that.
You see the truck with his cage on it. And they it's just in one brief shot. They're not like talking about it or going towards it. You just see it in the background. And I'm like, that.
So is Logan X-1?
No, he's X-23.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
Logan is Logan.
In the credits, they list him as X-23. Logan/X-23.
Oh, interesting. I wonder why they did it that way.
Oh,
no, X-23, because X-23 is the girl. She's X-23.
Well, okay, so the clone that he fights, that's...
X-24.
But isn't that played by
Hugh Jackman?
Yes.
Yep.
So are you sure? So are you sure that X-24 is not actually X-23?
Yes. this
oh,
got confusing.
Man. It did get confusing.
But another interesting thing is, in a certain sense, X-24, the clone of Logan, is in a certain way fan service, because though we're seeing this character story about this old Logan,
mm-hmm.
we're still getting our moments of like the brutal primal Wolverine just going nuts on people.
Yeah. I'm trying to look up the credits.
I feel like the girl is like the Chupacabra. It's like when I was thinking about that. She's like this Mexican beast thing going around. It's all small.
She did really good. I really liked her.
I thought she did really great.
You know, for not talking for like over half the film, I thought she was wonderful.
What's super cool, I don't know if you guys caught this, but it was super noticeable to me. So basically Wolverine's main love interest is Jean, right?
Yeah.
The Phoenix? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel like that girl looks a lot like Jean. Not that it's actually her daughter, but there was a resemblance. No, the face, the facial features. Hmm. Google it.
Okay.
Google it.
Okay. Let's touch on the moment with the death of Professor X, mm-hmm. and that family scene. That was a wonderful scene, like the part leading up to that, like, you know, that nice dinner they had, like they had some great moments, like they had that, like, you know, that initial, like, you know, frosty moments at the table, and then, you know, when
X-23 is Laura, by the way.
Yeah
sorry, keep going.
So you have that icy start, and then you have Professor X breaking the ice and making fun of Logan, and then Logan has his you know, he's able to put down his guard for a minute, mm-hmm. and joke with him, like that, like they're reminiscing about this shared past, this experience they've had together.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful. I was very curious when, after X-24 killed Professor X, I was curious what was going to happen to the family, because what I was kind of expecting was they were gonna, like, Logan was gonna be able to fight them off, and he was gonna give them the money. Or whatever, and then leave. Okay. But then we have this moment when, so we have this nice family, they're all killed, and also the dad tries to kill Logan too.
Yeah, which is sad, but
it's an honest reaction. It's like, when I was thinking, it was like, no, that he doesn't, like, we know that Logan's in the right, but he doesn't. All he sees is this death and destruction around him, and, you know, his wife and son killed, you know, feet away from him.
This movie definitely is akin to, like, our previous topic as far as things getting more and more gritty. This movie definitely got really gritty, even compared to, like, a lot of the other Wolverine movies. And I think I want to touch again a little bit more about what you brought up, David, as far as it following Deadpool as the second rated R superhero movie. Well, okay, hold on. So, because Watchmen is also rated R, and that's technically a superhero movie.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, yeah. That, okay. But real quick, I know listeners can't see this, but here's a side-by-side of the actress who plays Jean.
Okay. I can understand what you're coming
similar
from.
Similar kind of
the eyebrows, the jawline, the cheekbones. Okay, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
So it'd be like, okay, maybe a spiritual daughter.
Yep. Okay. I see what
Ben's
you mean.
Ben's still reserved.
I see what you mean.
I really like the ending. Very good payoff.
The cross turning into X.
Okay, yeah. Wait. We need to back. Before we get to that, the actual death of Wolverine, I teared up for that.
Oh, for sure.
I did too.
Ben did not.
Nope. Ben, you heartless man.
Man made of stone.
You heartless man. That, because correct me if I'm wrong, his last line was, so this is what it feels like.
Yeah.
Like, leading up to that, like, before that line, when he says, like, you know, you don't have to be what they made you to be or whatever. I'm like, okay, that's a nice moment. But with that line, then, mm-hmm. like, that was it. That was it for me. Like, that moment was, that was a really nice moment.
I thought it was a really great moment. To be fair, I did not cry, but I was definitely heartfelt.
Oh, get the hell out.
You're trying to save face now. Just leave it alone.
I really like that she said daddy. I would have preferred, like, papa, like Spanish.
That's true.
But still, you know, I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they, it sucks though, because I'm glad they had that moment, but I would have liked one little moment before that death scene of them, like, connecting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, yes, mean? Yes, absolutely.
Because, like, even up till that, the night before that, they had, like, a little mini fight.
Yep.
So it's like, they, even though they were getting closer, they were still resilient to like, opening up towards each other. Well, he was resilient to opening up until the very end. I would have liked just a little, little bit.
And I will say, I agree. Though, in some ways, you can see how they, in his own way, he has been warming up somewhat begrudgingly. Mm-hmm. It's in his own way is there, but yes, I would have liked an actual another moment.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the moment when, like, he is sleeping in the car and his head is on her lap, I liked that moment.
Yeah.
I would have liked it, that shot, just to stay there for like another 5 seconds, because like it was there and then she starts moving him to get out the door.
Yeah.
To move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have liked it to stay.
I agree.
For just, you know, 5-10 seconds longer.
Yeah.
Do you think she used her little feet knives to reach the pedals?
I was wondering how she was reaching the pedals. And Xavier mentions the whole lioness thing. I wanted her to use her foot knives again, but I don't think we saw her claws.
I think she did, but it's not a moment. I think in the final fight, there's moments when she kicks. Yeah, when she's kicking and you hear some moments.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but the cross thing.
I like that a lot.
Because when I was watching that, as soon as that opening shot, when you see Logan's grave and you see the cross, the first thing that went into my mind is like, it's interesting that it's a cross, because that's an accepted thing that everyone, when you see a cross and in that style, it's like it's a grave marker. It's like, you know, it's a very Christian symbol. I thought that was really interesting. It's like, okay, whatever. I'll let it slide. It's a convention. And then when she moved, it was like,
my
head exploded.
You know what? It actually took me a couple seconds.
Me again. Like,
when she turned it, I'm like, oh, it's interesting. Why did she tear? Oh, it's an X.
Then I started tearing up again with that one. It was like, oh my gosh.
Very, very cool.
That was the moment that got me.
I feel like this, even like I said, with some issue with like that, the arc of Wolverine as a character and his character development, this, I think, was a wonderfully fitting ending movie for both him and Patrick Stewart to be done with these characters.
Yeah.
And I think I was talking to one of my friends who's a huge superhero fan, superhero movies in the comics as well. And apparently Hugh Jackman has said that he would be willing to reprise Wolverine if it was in an Avengers film, if Sony and Marvel can get together to work something out. Because in some of the comic books, Wolverine does become one of the Avengers for a while.
But
And I think, no. I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, that'd be
this needs to be the memory I end with Wolverine. Yeah. Because again, like X-Men was one of the first superhero movies I watched ever. You know, even I think I may have even seen that before the original Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the superhero movies that I remember vividly, that and X-Men 2.
Yeah. It's so funny looking at Hugh Jackman in his very first X-Men film and how young and small he looks compared to how he had to bulk up from the later films. Yeah.
And also the hair.
And the hair, yeah. Oh, yeah. God, the hair. It was like, it reminds me of Ace Ventura.
How
it's done up in the Wolverine style. Mm-hmm. And it was very funny how they cut his beard.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was funny.
I really like, it was very cool to see him, because in the whole film, he's coughing up blood, he's weak, he's dying. And then once he sleeps, I swear there was like 10 different scenes of him sleeping. Once he finally got to their camp, but then he's like, he's trying to catch up to him, and he just gives himself the whole syringe, and he's just like, he just oh, that was loud. Sorry.
you fix that in post.
He just can't control his like adrenaline. I thought that was so cool. I'm just like, and then it starts to wear off, and I'm just like, no, keep going.
But, he's like, why did you have to do the whole thing? If you had done half, you would have been able to beat everybody.
But it was just that little push you needed to the climax of just like, he's just like, he's F it. He's like, I don't care if I die.
Yep.
Oh, what did they didn't really explain what the heck was across the border. Did they?
No.
I think the idea is crossing the border is partially moving into Canada. And this company would have has less.
They don't strike me as a company that gives two shits about what's legal and what's not.
Well, I think to a certain extent they do, because I think because it sounds like they have deals with the U.S. government. Like, I think like when like they're going through some of the carnage and looking at bodies, I think there's some like U.S. like military people there. So I think they have inns there. And also remember where all the bad stuff with the like experiment stuff, that's all in Mexico.
Yeah, but think of all the collateral damage of like the family that got murdered and all those guys that came to confront them. Like, those are people who live in that. They're all dead now.
Mm-hmm. But I think there's some alluding to like there are other people, or there's another place to go for safety.
Okay, but yeah, the whole thing of, It's just weird because the one scientist guy was like, don't let them reach the border. It's like, something tells me if they cross an invisible imaginary line, you're not going to be like, there's a force field.
No. It's Canada. There's a real line. There's a 20-foot wide swath of trees cut out the entire length of the border of the United States.
It's just like that one line. And I would have let it go if there was some more better explained reason, but they didn't go into it.
I was okay with it because it's one of those, In some ways, it may be the same as finding Eden. These coordinates that were pulled from the comic book, that it's almost this idea of mm-hmm. safety. Even like, even if it's not really there, it's a goal. It's the hope to getting there.
Oh, sure.
It's the, what is the next step? Where do we go next?
I'm fine with that. Totally. But the whole thing of like, once they reach the border, we're unable to reach them.
Yeah.
Do you think that they would continue on with these new established kids?
No.
At all? Because I think the girl did well enough where I would be interested to see what kind of happens with her.
First thing for her, I'm excited to see her as an actress in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I think I'm looking forward to what she may do next.
Yeah.
They won't because, and even the director who directed this film, I'm blanking on his name.
I have this up here.
When he's been asked about, when does Logan take place? James Mangold. When does it take place in the X-Men universe? He goes, it's a good Wolverine film. It's so, because the other thing is, remember, in this universe, all the other X-Men that we know are dead. Mm-hmm. So this is severely branched out from, like, this won't align with Days of Future, or like the first class young mutant thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think they will, because it wouldn't mesh with any kind of unified universe.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they will.
Okay. So I guess to sum up, I'm kind of confused, but did they explain, they were like, we have to cross the border today. After this, we won't be able to cross. Like, what? They didn't go into that.
Satellites. There was
To it. There's a period when the satellites overhead can't cover that area, so it's their chance to move and not be seen where they're going.
I see. Okay.
That might be another thing with why they were needing to catch them before the border.
Okay.
I totally missed that. Like, if we lose sight of them, it's going to become almost impossible to find them.
Daphne Keen Fernandez is the actress.
So where is she from? Is she? I was wondering about that. Is she of Hispanic or Latino descent? I was curious. I don't know Spanish at all, but she was doing the really rapid, fluent style of speaking.
Yeah.
She was just mile a minute in words or whatever.
I don't know for sure, but
okay.
I mean, just based off the name, it seems like, yeah,
mm-hmm.
She is, but, fantastic movie. I liked it, and I don't care. I don't typically get super into comic book films. I typically kind of just enjoy them. But if they are good stories in their own right, like we said, we could take out all the superhero stuff and it would still be a good movie. I'm into that. But slight dulled edge for me because of just how close it is to Last of Us and how much more I like The Last of Us than this story.
Yeah, that's fair.
So a little bit of a tempered edge, but still really like the movie. You guys, final thoughts?
I think it's good, and I will be buying it when it comes out on Blu-ray.
Cool.
I would agree with David that I want this to be the last Wolverine movie.
Yeah. and Professor X too.
Yeah.
I think, and they both said so. And again, there's a slight stipulation for Hugh Jackman, but I think just end here and I'll be happy.
Good capstone.
Yeah. Well, if we know Hollywood, we know they like making money, and if there's a chance they might, who knows, right?
Mm. Yep.
But anyway, regardless of that, thank you for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We'll be back next time with more to talk about. See you then.
Booty sweat.